Coming up on KUCB News, we revisit one of the bloodiest battles fought on American soil, and Gilmar Tepawin gets ready for his first prom. Stay tuned.
Local News is sponsored by Alpha Welding and Boat Repair Incorporated, providing boat repairs and conversions in Unalaska Dutch Harbor for the last 25 years. Our professionals are trained to use heavy-duty equipment, including boom trucks, shears, brakes, a water jet cutting machine, and a punch machine. Our fully equipped metal fabrication welding shop and machine shop are located at 1149 East Broadway. Alpha Welding and Boat Repair can be reached at 581-1785 or 581-2666.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Laura Craigle with some local news on Thursday, May 10th, 2018. 75 years ago, Japan and the United States were locked in one of the bloodiest battles fought on American soil, the Battle of Attu. The island is at the end of the Aleutian chain, closer to Japan than Seattle. Army veteran Alan Serrell is still haunted by the experience of staring down young men like himself.
Some of the guys noticed that it was bothering me. And I said, look, you kill or be killed. It's your own life that you're protecting. And they were right.
As KUCB's Zoe Sobel reports, the battle is unfamiliar to most, save World War II buffs, but it saved the lives of countless soldiers in the future. A note to listeners, one of the people in the story uses a word that is offensive for Japanese people.
Through the early morning haze of the Arctic day, United States troops are on the move, streaming in by the thousands to take up strategic positions somewhere in Alaska.
The United News Company documented the Aleutian Campaign. In 1943, American troops were streaming into Alaska in preparation for one of the deadliest battles of World War II. That's because 1 year earlier, Japanese soldiers bombed Dutch Harbor, seized Attu Island, and took the Alaska Native people who lived there as prisoners of war. It was the first time American soil had been invaded since the War of 1812. Soldiers like Bob Brocklehurst of the 18th Fighter Squadron were told that the Japanese were looking to invade the lower 48 by way of the Aleutian Chain.
They figured that the Japanese, if they had wanted to, could have come clear up in the Aleutians, take an anchorage and come down the east coast of Anchorage, past down Vancouver to Seattle, Washington.
But according to historian Jeff Dickrell, the Battle of Attu was really about reclaiming the stolen island.
There was a propaganda value in that. Some of the higher ranking people in the Joint Chiefs of Staff really wanted this cleared, the Aleutians cleared. They wanted to be able to say that the Japanese had been cleared from American soil.
Because the Japanese had the advantage of time, the Americans attacked with quadruple the force, more than 12,000 soldiers.
Beneath the barrage of a battleship's guns, United States forces move in to drive the Japanese from rocky, fog-bound Attu, strategic island in the Aleutian chain.
In this 1943 United News newsreel, soldiers clamber onto small boats overflowing with gear, motor to shore, and land on Attu.
The problem of supplying an expedition to take this vital subarctic outpost is tremendous. But the Americans are well trained for landing such as this, and they're bringing everything they'll need to hold Attu against any future attack.
The Americans brought heavy equipment, but the lack of roads made it useless. Signal Corps Sergeant Alan Serrell recalled his experience in an interview with the National Park Service.
It was strictly a foot job. You had to walk, you had to carry your equipment.
The battle started on May 11th. It was supposed to last a few days, but because of the conditions, it stretched to 19. The Americans slowly advanced on the Japanese from the north and south, slogging their way through snowy tundra. The Japanese were camped out high in the foggy mountains above the visibility line, and as the Americans sent scouts up into the hills to locate them, small skirmishes would break out when the two forces met. Many soldiers were young and inexperienced. Some had been training in the deserts of California for deployment in North Africa, so they weren't expecting the brutal Aleutian weather. It was constantly raining or snowing. But Serrell says worst of all was the wind.
You'd be walking along and all of a sudden you're flat on your face. It was unbearable. If you wanted to point a rifle, you just couldn't do it.
Not only that, soldiers like Joseph Sasser didn't have clothing suitable for the conditions.
We did have rain suits, but that could prove a disadvantage to you because of, as you were walking and so forth, you perspire. You didn't get enough air and you perspired. And then when you sat down to take a break, then you got cold.
Sasser was luckier than others. His clothes were wool, but he remembers some were sent with summer uniforms and struggled with chills up in the mountains. Poorly constructed leather boots that never dried and were difficult to untie led to trench foot, where tissue would die and feet would blacken and decay. On top of all that, Dickrell says the Americans had never gone head-to-head with the Japanese on land. Every other battle had happened in the sky or at sea.
When you fight on an island, there's nowhere to retreat to. So it is a battle to the end. There's no retreat. There's nowhere to go. And we didn't know how the Japanese would react to that.
By the end of May, both sides were feeling the toll of the battle. Food and supplies were scarce. The Japanese were down to 800 able-bodied men.
We didn't know if they would surrender once they were surrounded, or it was obvious they were going to lose. We didn't know if they would fight to the end, every single person. And the last thing we expected was a mass suicide.
The Japanese soldiers followed the Bushido Code, a samurai warrior ethic where surrender was dishonorable. They didn't expect to defeat the Americans. They expected to die fighting. Every Japanese soldier who could walk assembled for a final bonsai charge, trying to catch the Americans off guard. 20-year-old Sasser was part of that last stand on Engineer Hill.
The Japanese just kept coming up the ravines, stacked on top of each other. And some, seeing that everything was futile, nothing they could do, they just took their hand grenades and pulled a pin on it and blew their stomach out completely.
Cyril was there, too. He heard the commotion and ran over.
When the Japs came running at us, yelling and screaming, you know, they were ridiculous. They had the grenades wrapped around their forehead or around their chest. We lost quite a number of guys from the grenades.
549 Americans died fighting. The Japanese casualties were catastrophic. 2,300 men died and only 28 soldiers were captured. Both Cyril and Sasser helped bury the dead in mass graves. But the real killer on Attu was the weather and disease. It took more American soldiers out of action than the Japanese. A Pathé news clip describes the scene.
After 3 weeks of costly fighting, Attu was taken, marking the first major American victory since Guadalcanal. Japan's high-water mark advance was stopped dead. A turning tide proved a military milestone of the century.
After this battle with so many unexpected losses, the U.S. stepped back and tried to learn from it. Attu veterans were interviewed so that other soldiers could be better trained and prepared for the cold conditions. Changes were also made to Army footwear, clothes, outdoor gear, and food to prevent injuries. While they were too late to save the lives and limbs of Attu veterans, military officials credit the lessons learned with preventing casualties in the Italian campaign. But many of those who fought in the cold and dodged the Japanese grenades came through the experience with more complicated feelings. Looking back on the battle, Cyril says it was hard to wrap his mind around his own survival.
When something good happened, I looked up and I said, "Thank you, God." What it did was it made me feel good to know that the war with the Japanese was over and that I survived it. Mm-hmm. But what about the poor guys that didn't survive it? Japanese or American. Feel luck. What else can you say?
After the fighting died down, Cyril remained stationed on Attu. He spent time exploring the island, collecting samples of plants and filling a book with pressed flowers. Now, 75 years later, he says he hasn't forgotten the battle. Back then, it bothered him to shoot people, and that's still true today.
And when you see people fall, it does something to you. I keep thinking, these people, they either have wives or they have parents. How different are they from us? They're wearing a different uniform.
Today, Attu is uninhabited. The Attuans who survived imprisonment in Japan were never allowed to return home. The only hint of the island's wartime history is the abandoned equipment left to rust. In On Alaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
Next week, we'll have more stories looking back at the Battle of Attu and the Greater Aleutian Campaign, examining their impact and legacy today. If you live in Unalaska, you probably know Gilmar Tapawan. Last year, as a freshman in high school, Gilmar had big plans for his prom debut, so KUCB's Zoe Sobel shadowed him as he prepared for the big day. A note to listeners, the story contains language that may not be suitable for young listeners.
I am Gilmar Tapawan. I want to be someone who's out there, open about my sexuality, can wear whatever the heck I want, and if someone got beef with me, I'm gonna scratch them.
Starting out as a kid, like a five-year-old kid, Gilmar would steal his grandma's heels and wear them around the house. And as he's gotten older, he's kind of grown and expanded more, so now he's doing makeup or he's tried on a wig. He's has his own pair of heels now.
I just wanted to be different. Like, he wants to do the same thing over and over again, like, day after day. Like, no. I just was experimenting, and if I liked it, I liked it. Actually, watching RuPaul for the first time, I had mixed emotions because this is what I was, like, doing. Like, I didn't even know.
He finally saw people that were kind of like him. It wasn't necessarily just about the clothes, but there also was this intangible something else that goes along with it.
This is not RuPaul's best friend's race. I have one thing to say. May I call you Jiggly?
He saw the way that they behaved and the way they carried themselves and really just wanted to get more into that additional level of fierceness. He saw his next step. And this is when Gilmar decided to be a drag queen for prom.
Hi, Grandma. Could you put the money in my account?
You can't just go to the store and buy a dress in Unalaska. The only way to get stuff is online.
Okay. I am ordering my prom dress. It is a short but sexy dress. It has sequins. And, what are these called?
Rhinestones.
Pretty quickly, Gilmar had orders in for everything he needed. He had his dress, he had his heels, he got new makeup, he got new makeup brushes, he ordered his eyelashes. The problem was really all that Gilmar knows about drag is from the episodes of RuPaul he's watched.
Learning how to do all this stuff on my own, it's really hard because if you don't have a reference to go to, like, trial and error.
Gilmar was looking for a mentor, someone who actually was a drag queen and someone who could answer his questions and tell him what it was really like. So our friends at WNYC's Nancy podcast set Gilmar up with his very own fairy drag mother from RuPaul's Drag Race.
Ladies, I've made my decision. Alaska. You are a winner, baby.
Alaska Thunderf***.
Oh my God. No way.
Tomorrow. At what time?
2:30.
Oh, that's fine with me.
How do you say the name of your city? Because I've read it, but I don't know how to say it.
Unalaska.
It's literally called Unalaska?
Yeah.
That's like the opposite of me, Unalaska.
Yeah.
So when we started the Skype call and the video comes up, there is Alaska in full drag. She's wearing this pink floral top with peacocks, teased up blonde hair topped with a pink rhinestone encrusted clip.
I guess you were bit by the bug of drag, right? Like, you're like, mm-hmm. You feel like you are a drag queen.
Yes.
Because I feel it's like being a nun. It's like a divine calling.
And she was in front of this backdrop that really just made her look like she was floating in outer space. And Gilmar, on the other hand, is pretty nervous because I think it's one thing to watch a video of drag queens, but it's a whole nother ballgame to talk face to face with one.
What's your drag name?
Glimmer.
Oh, see, I love that. That's brilliant. That's stunning.
Yeah, once I told my best friends, they were like, it's really catchy and smooth.
It is, and it's based off your real name. So yeah. That's pretty cool. I love it. Can I get down to the serious question, please?
Sure.
What are you wearing to prom?
I'm wearing like a cocktail dress. It's black.
Okay. Do you have shoes?
They're like the stilettos with lace.
Oh my God.
I think it's seven inches.
What about hair?
I just ordered a new wig that's coming in. It's black with a little brown on the tips.
I'm sure people are going to gag when they see you. Have you told people you're going in drag?
Yeah, I told probably everybody.
Okay.
And they're really excited to see me. The principal knows, and he was like, as long as it's not showy, you're good.
So it's like, showy? Oh, okay. What does that mean?
It kind of means like showing too much breast, most likely. Or like too short of a dress.
So like too provocative.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. It's always better to go for tasteful, especially at a school function.
Yeah. As a high schooler, what did prom mean to you?
I sort of thought of prom as like kind of a joke. I thought it was kind of ridiculous. And my mom like did the thing where like we went to the tux rental place or whatever, and we rented the outfit and we rented the shoes. And I hated the pants so much. I was like, they were like tapered at the bottom and they like fit me weird, and I hated them. And I hated the shoes. They were so uncomfortable. So as soon as we left the house, I brought a change of clothes, and I changed into these like old man pants that I had cut at the bottom, so they were like flares, and I wore my Converse like sneakers, and I had so much fun. And the thing is, I was nominated for prom king because I was the only gay kid, and the girls vote for the prom king and the boys vote for the prom queen. So like, of course the girls were gonna vote for like their gay friend rather than like some guy that, you know, they dated for a week and now they hate. So yeah. I won prom king. It's still so surreal to me.
What was it like growing up being the only gay kid?
I mean, it was weird, but I clung to my friends. And it's not just being gay that makes you feel like you don't belong in high school. Probably most people in high school feel like weird or like they don't belong. But that's high school. High school kind of sucks, like all around.
It does.
Yeah. However, it's getting up, putting on your clothes, going and doing the damn thing. That builds strength, and it's going to make you the person that you're going to grow up to be.
On those hard days, how did you deal with it?
I drew pictures. I drew pictures of beautiful women. So now I basically draw pictures of beautiful women on myself and then go out into the world. But now I think back on it, and I'm like, that was research for what I'm doing now. You know, it was like practice. When I first like went out to a club in drag, we made like a tube top and a skirt out of garbage bags because I didn't have any girl clothes that I wanted to wear to the club. So my best friend Elena from high school, who I actually consider to be my drag mother, she did my makeup and she put lashes on me and she taught me how to do that stuff. And then she like took this really plain, like, blonde wig, and I was like, it isn't big enough, it isn't big enough. So she, like, mm-hmm. teased the top and gave it, like, volume. Now I still wear garbage bags all the time, and I still wear teased up blonde hair, so really nothing has changed.
Hmm. Wow. How do you deal with those people that hate you?
Well, mostly I ignore them. I don't read comments on photos or videos because I think that it's really easy to say mean stuff online because there's such a barrier between, like, mm-hmm. reality and this. So it's like, take the negative and, like, own it and embrace it, and then just make it to something that's a source of power for you.
Embrace the hate.
Embrace it, yes.
I try so hard to, like, absorb that hate, but it's like, it kind of gets to me.
I mean, you're going to prom and drag. Like, you're f***ing doing drag for your prom. Like, that's amazing. At 15 years old, you are embracing the difficulty and the struggle, and you're being brave in the face of that. Like, that's how you get through life. That's how you be successful. So, like, you're doing it. You are doing it.
You're making me blush.
Aw. Me too. I swear it's not makeup. I'm actually blushing.
Thank you.
Have a great prom. Send me pictures.
I will. Bye.
Bye.
After his conversation with Alaska, Gilmar was ready for prom. Confident, excited. You could tell as soon as Gilmar started getting ready, he became a totally different person.
We're at my prom date's house doing my makeup. And she is putting on more foundation.
Contouring.
My name is Delaney McConnell. I'm a senior.
This is just, like, first time ever doing his makeup, like, for me, so I'm like, oh, let's be careful, because I want him to feel beautiful.
You already make me beautiful.
Oh, don't say
that. We're about to do the big reveal. It's really nerve-wracking.
Delaney didn't let Gilmar see what he looked like, so after about 45 minutes, we're all done, and that's going to be the first time that Gilmar gets to see what Glimmer looks like.
3, 2, 1.
Goddamn! I look good!
I was standing in this cramped bathroom with a beautiful, classy Amazon.
And this is Glimmer for you. Some sexy mofo.
Grand March. Welcome to prom 2017. Parents, family, and most importantly, moms with cameras, you've got about 10 minutes to take all the rest of your pictures.
Prom is huge in Unalaska. It's held in the elementary school gym, but if you hadn't been there before, you really couldn't tell. And people from town, even if they don't have kids, are lined up outside just so that they can go in and see the decorations, and most importantly, all the kids' outfits.
Ms. Delaney McConnell and Mr. Gilmar Topowin.
Gilmar is probably about 5'9 normally, but with heels on, Glimmer was well over 6 feet tall. So all night you have Glimmer kind of just, you always know where she is because she's so tall. So whether or not, like, Glimmer is breaking it down on the dance floor or, like, walking over to talk with friends, like, she was just such a commanding presence.
Party, party! Time to party. Hey, Kevin.
Prom just ended, and being as Glimmer, oh my God, it was so fun. Sure, like, it was my first time dragging. I heard people say, hey, now you look so beautiful, Gilmar. I was like, I was gonna correct them, but I was like, you know what? I'll just deal with it. Like, Glimmer, Gilmar, same thing, but Glimmer will come out and play on 4th of July. And I can, for a show,
tell you that. And probably next prom, she will probably be in a tuxedo. The tux will be black with the inside pink. And she's gonna go all her natural hair. And I'm gonna have that pink ass look. And I'm gonna look fierce as hell.
This story was produced by KUCB's Zoe Sobel. Special thanks to WNYC's Nancy Podcast for connecting Gilmar with Alaska. You can check out pictures of Gilmar at prom at kucb.org, and even if you're not in high school, you can see the Unalaska prom yourself this Saturday night. The prom viewing starts at 9 o'clock and is open to the community. And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Laura Craigle, and you're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org, and please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecasts.